I'm Barbara Lane, Director of Arts and Ideas at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guests are the New York Times columnist Roger Cohn and contributing editor and critic of The Atlantic, Leon Wieseltier. And now, join me on stage at the JCCSF as I introduce Roger Cohn and Leon Wieseltier. Roger Cohn is a columnist for the New York Times, where he has worked since 1990 as Paris correspondent, bureau chief in the Balkans and Berlin, and foreign editor. Prior to that, he was a foreign correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. His books include Soldiers and Slaves, American POWs Trapped by the Nazis' Final Gamble, and Hearts Grown Brutal, Sagas of Sarajevo. His new book, The Girl from Human Street, Ghosts of Memory in a Jewish Family, is the story of his family's suffering and success from Lithuania to South Africa, London, and Tel Aviv. Within it is the broader story of Jewish devastation, displacement, and cultural identity. Leon Wieseltier was until recently the literary editor of The New Republic. He is currently a contributing editor and critic at The Atlantic. His books include Kaddish and Nuclear War, Nuclear Peace. Please welcome Roger Cohn and Leon Wieseltier to the JCCSF.
Good evening. Roger and I, who are old friends and comrades, are going to be discussing his book and then the world. I'm going to begin with some conversation about this extraordinary book, and then we'll open it up in our discussion, and then there will be questions, hopefully of an interrogative kind. And this is, if those of you haven't read this book, I can report that it is a gorgeous book. It is a soulful book. It is a book that accomplishes something. Roger, you'll just have to suck this up.
I'll try, Leon. Yes. I'll try.
It is a book that accomplishes something that's very hard to do, which is that it somehow manages to incorporate the story of individual history with collective history. It moves from a family and certain individuals in a family to the very largest framework of the 20th century, actually earlier too, but mainly the 20th century history of the Jews and all its turbulences. It is a book by a son and a book by a Jew. And I guess one definition of being a Jew is being a son or a daughter, as the case may be. Why don't we begin, Roger, by talking a little bit about the question of uprootedness. The whole, you know, in your book you describe Jews who moved around the world under the pressures of history, none of which they asked for, of course. You describe very probingly the psychology, the spirituality, really, of people who live either in the wrong places or in places where they feel they don't belong. Why don't we talk about that?
Well, thank you, Leon, and thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for coming out tonight. It's always a pleasure for me to be back in San Francisco. I was just thinking it's 41 years since I was hitching around the United States and saw the Grateful Dead play San Francisco, and it remains...
Things have changed, Roger.
One of them. One of my greatest memories.
Insofar as you can remember.
I was internally displaced as I watched it. But, nevertheless, the pleasure was intense. Now then. Yes, this is a central theme of the book. I was born in London to South African immigrant parents, and I knew very little, really, of the history of the family. The goal was assimilation. The goal was to become English. We didn't hide who we were called Cohen. But that was not, our Jewish identity was not really, it was peripheral. And as I grew up, and when I was called an effing yid and a Jew boy in school, I began to think about what I didn't know. I had a very privileged upbringing in Britain. I was at Westminster School, one of the finest schools in Britain. I'd sit in Westminster Abbey most mornings, and I had no idea that my grandmother had come from the Lithuanian shtetl. And my family has moved with every generation in the last four, from Lithuania to South Africa to Britain, then a part went from South Africa to Israel, and I've become an American and moved on to New York. And the more I began to think about this, and the more I began also to think about my mother's breakdown when she was plucked out of a very tight-knit and prosperous Jewish community in South Africa. Her grandfather had been penniless when he arrived in South Africa, but he began as a Smouse itinerant salesman, then had a small retail operation, and then started the Macy's of South Africa, the OK Bazaars, which then went bankrupt. But there was a phase in there where there was quite a lot of money, and my mother grew up in these circumstances, was plonked down in post-war Britain with its rationing still, putting pennies in the meter for hot water, and with a very hard-driving young husband and pregnant with my younger sister. And she cracked up. And I wanted to tell an intimate story of my mother's breakdown, because since she died 15 years ago, there'd been this knot inside me about her life and about what I didn't know about her life. And we all have something that makes us tick. And for me, it's words. If I have a knot, I try and write the knot out word by word. And I thought that in my mother's story of displacement, there lurked a wider story of people, not just Jews. It's principally about Jews, but it's called The Girl from Human Street. Of this, I think it's a very basic urge, this quest, this longing, this desire to belong. I think it's right up there with love, and it's probably among the three or four most basic human urges, is this urge to belong. And I think when you're moving with each generation, that's very hard. We think of immigration in the United States as new hope, new opportunity. But its black sun is lost. It's what you leave behind, and what sometimes you strive, usually fruitlessly, I think, to forget.
And the inner resources of immigrants have to be prodigious if they're not going to be defeated by the experience. Jewish identity has survived for all these many centuries because it became portable. And what's so moving about your portrait of your mother is that it's a portrait of a woman whose identity turned out not to be really portable, that somehow she really did not, she needed her place.
And she did. She always craved South Africa, particularly as her life went on. And I actually think that her Jewish identity was stronger than my father's. He was a very distinguished, is still, nearly 94, very distinguished scientist, immunologist, expert on malaria, and he'd hated his bar mitzvah. He saw it was obscurantist to him. He believed in something more universalist. He wanted to move out from Jewish identity. When he moved to Britain, one of his aunts in South Africa said to him, "You'll never make it in Britain as a Cohen. You really must change your name." And he said, "Okay, well, I'll think about that. Let me think about it." And he went away for 3 or 4 days and went back to see this aunt. And she said, "So, Sydney, what did you decide?" And he said, "Well, I've been thinking about it, and you're right. I'm going to change my name." And she said, "Oh, really? That's wonderful. To what?" And he said, "Einstein." Yeah. My dad was not a man who was going to change his name. He was not going to hide who he was, but it didn't interest him particularly. My mother, on the other hand, I think her uncle, great-uncle, my great-great-uncle, was a rabbi, and was one of the things I discovered writing the book, who was the chaplain to Jewish soldiers in the British Army during World War I. Yeah. And I found his diaries in the University of Southampton, and it was quite fascinating to me, going back to what we were talking about. He wrote, for example, in 1918, I'm paraphrasing, has the House of Israel at last demonstrated with its sacrifice that we are loyal citizens, loyal to the crown and to the empire? Always this question of belonging. Do we belong? Do we really belong? And I think for my mother, that definitely lingered there. And she was uneasy. The transmission belt, as you just said, is the parchment passed down, the words passed down through the millennia. And I felt personally, and it's one reason I've returned to a Jewish identity, that for this transmission belt to end, it's some kind of tremendous betrayal of what came before. And I think my mother found really nothing to replace that. She always, I recount in the book how we sat when I was in my teens in a restaurant in London, and she said she was eating spaghetti, I remember. And my mother always used to cut up her spaghetti and eat it on a spoon. And she said to me, "Darling, you see that family over there?" I said, "Yeah." I see. She said, "Well, they're Jewish." And I said, "Mom, why are you whispering?" And she said, "I'm not whispering, but they are Jewish." And this is Philip Roth's observation also about being Jewish in Britain. If you're discreet, you make your way, and Jews do very well in Britain. But for me personally, coming to New York and seeing that, oh, you can live Jewishness exuberantly, was an extraordinary discovery.
American Jews do not whisper.
They do
not.
Just,
I mean, it's...
Do they not?
No. A little whispering would actually go a long way around. One of the things that your book recounts is the awakening of your own Zionism. And Zionism, among its many other qualities, is not just an affirmation, a positive affirmation of Jewish peoplehood and so on, but it also is an expression of despair with the Jewish experiment in belonging in Europe, especially, historically speaking. But in your case, too, judging by what's in the book, there is some sense
it's
exactly
in exactly that. I think it's I think it was a reluctant conclusion.
Yeah, yeah.
It was reluctant. I think Herzl, covering the Dreyfus case 120 years ago in Paris as a foreign correspondent, I think his conclusion, observing these false accusations against a Jewish officer in the French army and observing the tremendous outburst among the anti-Dreyfusards of a virulent anti-Semitism, it was a significant factor in his writing.
Well, this is
the Jewish state. And, and in my own family's case, they fled the shtetl in Lithuania because of the pogroms there. They were privileged in South Africa because they were the right color, and members of my family used to say, remember, darling, if there weren't tens of millions of blacks as a buffer to persecute, you know, when you're persecuting tens of millions of blacks, you don't have a lot of time left over for tens of thousands of Jews.
Right.
And a lot of Jews went along, a lot of more Jews as a group among whites than any other. Of course, fought apartheid, including some of my relatives and most of Mandela's attorneys, as you know, were Jews. But even in South Africa, I know my father and uncle told me about being excluded in school, and this unease was always there, and certainly it's always there in Europe. And my own Zionism, I suppose, was... I don't see any other conclusion. Half-acceptance into Christian societies proved more dangerous for the Jews than non-acceptance. It was as the Jews in France, in Germany, and elsewhere emerged in the professions, into European societies, that really the seeds were scattered for what became Nazism. And my great uncle's anxiety in Britain proved absolutely well founded. An Iron Cross for valor at the Somme for a German Jewish officer
did not
prevent him being sent to the gas 30 years later.
I mean, it is historically, psychologically easy to understand why Jews would have wished to integrate into Europe, especially at a time when it seemed like Europe was becoming an enlightened place. But what happened eventually with Herzl and others, and what seems to be part of your story here, is that finally the experience of history leads one to the conclusion that the experiment failed in some way.
Yeah, it did, and we're seeing in Europe today...
That's right.
The shootings in Brussels at the Jewish Museum, and of course what has just happened in Paris in the kosher supermarket. And there's a significant exodus right now from France because of this new fear in Europe. We're not back in the 1930s, far from it.
No.
And what we're seeing is the seeping of poisonous Middle Eastern politics into Europe. But it is a worrying situation.
But there is this feeling...
And, you know, of course, the state of Israel is a miracle. It's remarkable. But my own Zionism is a liberal Zionism. I don't think a Jewish state founded on the statelessness of another people is what the original Zionists had in mind. And I see the messianic Zionism that is often ascendant in Israel today, which believes that all the land between the Mediterranean Sea and the Jordan River was deeded to the Jews in the Bible. I think it's very corrosive and fundamental in Jewish teaching, obviously, is we were strangers in strange lands. We should invite the stranger, and that which is hateful to yourself, do not do to another. I mean, these are very fundamental Jewish ethics, which I think are being challenged by the current situation.
Well, we're certainly of one view about that. The pathos of the situation of the French Jews, which repeats a situation that Jews found themselves in earlier, which is why the massacres have created for the French Jews or crystallized for the French Jews a kind of classical Zionist moment, is that they have... Their confidence in liberalism to protect them has been rattled. After all, France is a liberal state. And in some ways, the melancholy aspect of it is their decision, and this was the case of many Western European Zionists, that liberalism...
It was a melancholy decision.
It's a melancholy decision.
I think
decision.
That's a very good way of putting
Absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. It was... I mean, in Eastern Europe and in Russia, in the Pale of Settlement, it was different. There was no liberalism, there was no middle class, there was no revolution of rising expectations. But in Western Europe, it was... And so you're right. Basically, what Zionist Jews should do is, having despaired of liberalism in Europe, basically take their liberalism with them to their own state and enact it there.
You know, it's a very old story in France. I've been thinking about it a lot since what happened at Charlie Hebdo and at the kosher supermarket. You know, looking back to Dreyfus and of course, France is a secular state.
Yeah.
It tries to make no distinctions, but you have a very combustible situation there now, I think, with a marginalized and large Muslim community. And I wanted to get to the bottom of my mother's story, and I wanted to get the bottom of where I came from. And I think those two things are really what came together in the book, and I was able to discover. I think it's painful as it is. I think we need to remember. We need to know. We need foundations. And what foundations can you build if you don't know the story of your family and you don't know the story of where you came from? And this is what I felt I had to explore and try to write about. And as a columnist, of course, I get a lot of emails. And I do think that some of the mental illness and some of the this desire to belong that I try to explore in the book, I think it's a more widespread condition than perhaps we imagine. There's a lot of unease out there amid a humanity that is perhaps more fluid than ever and often more uncertain about where home lies.
You're listening to the New York Times columnist Roger Cohn and contributing editor and critic of The Atlantic, Leon Wieseltier, on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
In this book, which recounts, as I say, the discovery of your own positive feelings about Jewish identity and Zionism and the historical necessity for a Jewish homeland and so on, the figure of your mother haunts that story in the following sense, that what's sometimes lost in all the upbeat accounts of Zionism and in all the expressions of pride, of Jewish pride and so on, is that there are people who are inconsolable about the loss of what they knew. And all the ideology in the world, there are people for whom it will never suffice to heal the rupture of either having been robbed or expelled from their home, or of simply of movement. I mean, racination is a very, very... Powerful thing.
It was a huge trauma for my mother. Look, my family was lucky. We skirted the horror. I went back to Zagore in northern Lithuania and Shavel, as it was called in Yiddish, in northern Lithuania where my family was from. And on June 2, 1941, everybody, all the Jews, 2,473 of them, were shot dead and buried out in the forest. And so that's what would have happened to my family. Lithuanian Jews were killed fast and killed locally. They did not go to the gas. There were no gas chambers. Between June and December 1941, before the Wannsee Conference, the Jews of the Baltics were wiped out. And that is where the Nazis crossed the psychological barrier to killing women and children en masse. And it's, you know, these are devastating stories.
I mean, my family was, it didn't skirt my family. It visited them directly in Poland. And one of the things that always puzzled me as a child growing up among Holocaust survivors is this strange mixture of contempt for where they came from because of all the evil that was perpetrated there, with a strong degree of nostalgia.
It was very moving for me going back to Zagore. I'd never heard of it growing up. I had no idea. I mean, my grandmother used to speak in Russian to her parrot, but apart from that, there was absolutely no connection. And one of the moving things in the, for me in the exploration, it was a voyage of discovery, this book. I was going back. I was trying to reel in the past. Because of the internet, of course, the Zagore diaspora is more linked than it's ever been since the Jews disappeared from Zagore. Just before I got there, the last Jew in Zagore had died. And because what happened in Zagore happened in every Lithuanian town. And there are ditches, and if you delve into the forest there, you find these hidden plaques that used to say under the Soviets...
Victims of fascism.
No identification of Jews. Then it got a little better after Lithuanian independence, and it said they were Jews, but it did not say that some were killed by the Lithuanian accomplices of the Nazis. And now, in Zagore, for the first time, and it's in one of the last chapters of my book, a plaque was put up, not in the forest, in the main square, saying that almost 3,000 Jews had been killed on October 2nd, 1941, by the Nazis and their Lithuanian accomplices. It can take a very long time, ladies and gentlemen, to get to historical truth. And it's very important. I covered the war in the Balkans, in Bosnia. It was all about distorted memory. It was about nationalist leaders who used old, who reopened old wounds, who used old grievances, who traded in the
14th century
traded
grievances.
In the absence of historical truth. That was their raw material, the fact that there was no agreed upon history. And it's very dangerous. You need to try and establish what happened. Even if in Israel-Palestine, I often think it doesn't matter any longer what happened in 1948. Palestinians and Jews, Arabs and Jews, will never agree on the narrative of 1948. But please, let's be more prosaic. Let's try to put food on the table. Let's think of the future, not the past. But unfortunately, the current leaders are very reluctant to do that.
Well, one of the interesting things, that one way to look at the Israeli-Palestinian conflict in terms of the question of displacement and racination is that what you have is a conflict. The Palestinians, or many of them, refuse to settle for anything but the return of their grandfather's house and olive tree, of their home. And the Jews, or some of them, believe that every place a Jew once lived, Jews must always live. And peace between Israelis and Palestinians in some ways will be premised upon their willingness to leave home for the sake of a larger home.
Exactly.
I'm
not very interested in the olive groves of 1948, and I'm not very interested in the notion of land somehow deeded in the Bible. Why is this land ours? Because it is. That's what you hear sometimes.
Well, anyway, the state
the
of
settlers.
Israel.
Look, if you're trying to, you need basic signals. If you're trying, if you're serious about a two-state peace, which I think is the only kind of peace that's possible, while you're negotiating, I don't think it's helpful to expand the settlements. In fact,
it's lunatic.
I think it's lunatic.
It's lunatic.
And on the other side, if you're serious about making, if you're interested in the 1967 lines and not 1948, not pushing the Jews into the sea again, which is never going to happen, it is not helpful, it is equally not helpful to continue with incitement against Jews, and both sides have to be more serious.
Well, but the conclusion to which one inevitably comes is that since none of them are fools and they all know this, the people who are now in charge of both Palestinian affairs and Israeli affairs are fundamentally not interested in a two-state solution.
I think that's the only conclusion.
It's the only conclusion one can come to.
When I was in Israel in December, in any democracy there's a shelf life for a leader, and Prime Minister Netanyahu has now been in office for 9 years, and I sense for the first time a real fatigue with his leadership. But Israelis want to be assured that any alternative in a crisis will see leading Israel somebody who will guarantee the security of Israel. And that's the challenge to Isaac Herzog, the Labour Party leader, and Tzipi Livni. But one reason I think a change of leadership is precisely, would be very important, is precisely that, because Livni and Herzog are no doves, but I do think that they see the conundrum. Israel cannot remain a Jewish and democratic state if it continues to occupy all the land, because one day there will be more Arabs on that land. One day, quite soon, more Arabs on that land. They see it, they understand it, and they believe in a two-state outcome. I have never been convinced that Prime Minister Netanyahu believed in that. So that is a very fundamental difference.
I think that's right. I think that there's always been the Zionism of numbers and the Zionism of borders. Mm-hmm. And Netanyahu comes from the tradition of the Zionism of borders that insists either upon Jabotinsky's idea of borders, of the patriarch Abraham's idea of borders, as if the Bible has a damn thing to do with the state of Israel anyway.
Right. But
and then there's the Zionism of numbers, according to which the whole purpose of the state is that there be a place in which the Jews are permanently the majority. Now, there is an irony here, going back to France and your book, which is this. Israel was founded upon essentially a European kind of nationalism. That is to say, the kind of nation-state that Israel was taken from the European idea that every nation should be incarnated in a state and every state should reflect a nation, that the political and the cultural boundaries should coincide. And since they never do, all European nation states had the so-called problem of minorities, which is Israel having reproduced that kind of nationalism, which has no natural understanding of multi-ethnicity at all, but sees it only in terms of the majority and the problem of minorities, Israel has now inherited that problematic structure, that problematic structure. And it's very difficult. I mean, I don't know about you. It's a very sad thing to admit, but I have basically given up on the prospect of seeing peace there in my lifetime. I don't believe I'm going to see it.
Yeah, I haven't given up. That's not a rational position, but I've not given up. Maybe it's the South African in me. I spent my whole childhood hearing about the inevitable cataclysm. It was coming. It was coming. The blacks at the horizon would come and take everything. And my relatives were always saying, when I went out there every December, January, enjoy the swimming pools. Next year they'll be red with blood.
Yeah.
And it never happened. And why did it never happen? Because of leadership, because of de Klerk and Mandela. And it's an extraordinary thing, and it marked me. And I was also marked, of course, as we all were, by the end of the Cold War. I mean, again, nobody foresaw it. I think these huge events are very seldom foreseen. The Arab Spring has turned bitter, but nobody foresaw that. And again, it was about empowerment. It was about individuals saying they should have a say in the running of their countries. And I was recently reviewing Lawrence Wright's book on Camp David for the New York Review of Books. And again, we come back to leadership. Begin was the first right-wing prime minister of Israel. And he went into those talks since the country's foundation. And he went into those talks with one bottom line. He was never, ever, under any circumstances, going to give up the settlements in Sinai. In fact, he was going to retire to one of the settlements in Sinai. And what did he do? He gave up the settlements in Sinai. And President Sadat, who paid it with his life, as we know, was intensely pragmatic. He wanted Sinai back. That's what he wanted. He wanted an end to the wars with Israel, which had taken more than 100,000 Egyptian lives. And he wanted to align Egypt with the United States, bring it out of the Moscow camp. He achieved his objectives. He was fiercely pragmatic. I wish there was more pragmatism on the Palestinian side. I really do. I think there's a lot that could be learned from Sadat in terms of you can't get everything. You simply can't. And Mahmoud Abbas is 80 years old now, and I don't think he's prepared to tell the Palestinians the tough things, which include the fact that we're not going back to Haifa. We're not going back to those olive groves. We can have a state of our own. We can build something wonderful. And 100 years from now, maybe the border between Palestine and Israel will be as meaningful as the border between Israel and France. Speaking of miracles, I lived in Berlin for 3 years, and I would drive into Poland, 70 miles away. The Poles know something about having the Germans that close. And you didn't even know where the border was, in a place where 12 million people were killed 70 years ago. So I don't give up.
There's a wonderful line in a play by Oscar Wilde. In Salome, Herod and Herodiad are out on the terrace, and there's a shooting star. And Herodiad says, it's a miracle. And Herod says, I don't believe in miracles. I've seen too many.
Yeah.
I think there is some basis, of course, to what you're saying. Yeah. People do forget that when the Zionists accepted partition, it required the renunciation of the maximalist Zionist vision.
Yes, it did.
And that renunciation
was
such
very
a bitter
pragmatic.
And to the extent to which the Zionist camp it resulted in civil war. There was actually violence about this.
There was.
And people do not, but the Palestinian leadership has consistently refused to do what Ben-Gurion did consistently, that is, faced with the choice between a state that expresses less than their full vision on the one hand and continued Palestinian wretchedness on the other, they have consistently chosen to preserve the integrity of the national movement, whatever that means. There is no such integrity.
And it's divided right now.
Completely. It has been divided for decades.
Yeah. But Leon, could I ask you a question?
Yes.
What are we to make of this metastasizing and heinous ideology that is drawing young Muslims from Europe to Syria and elsewhere, and was behind the murder? We're journalists. We've sat around tables. We've thought about next day's stories, cartoons. But some guy comes in and, in the name of this ideology, wipes everyone out. Then the kosher supermarket. President Obama, when he speaks of this, speaks of extremists. He doesn't speak of Islamist extremists or identify this ideology in any way, even with a perversion of Islam. What is to be done? How should we see this ideology? How do we fight it? We've been trying to fight it for quite a long time now.
I think there are many things to be said about it. Some of them are these. In the first place, these people are not to be described as nihilists or as operating a cult of death. This is a belief system. They believe in certain positive propositions. And we have to recognize that part of their appeal is to the wounded identities of Muslims in many countries. The second thing is that it is idiotic not to refer to it as Islamist terrorism. But when one does that, one has to recognize that Islam, like Judaism, like Christianity, is not just a religion, it's a civilization, and it contains all the temperaments, and there are all the vices and all the virtues in it. And that Islam, like Judaism and like Christianity, but especially like Judaism, is a religion of interpretation. And what people like the president don't understand is that this is an interpretation of Islam. And there are other interpretations of Islam. One of the things that is so frustrating to behold or not to behold for me, and I don't read Arabic, I'm embarrassed to say, or Urdu, so I can't follow it, is that one looks for a war of ideas within the Islamic world. One looks for the assertion of the other Islams, as
one does.
And again, one doesn't see them, at least in what I read in the various Western languages. I think that these are the upside of this, and it's hard to begin a sentence that way, is that every attempt to modernize, and this was true of the West too, always produces a great recoil from modernization. And I think that as these societies begin to understand that they have to begin to open up to not just to the West, but to democracy, to technology, to social progress and so on, the Saudis are going to begin to have to deal with this and so on, this produces a corresponding recoil, this horror of modernity, this horror of democracy, and that's partly what we're seeing. I don't know the question of how do we fight it, not with 120,000 troops, but not without military force at all. I think what's happened in this country, and Obama's particularly prone to this, is that the only options that seem to stand to confront the United States are either inaction or the war in Iraq. And the war in Iraq was a fluke. That's not going to happen again. And anyway, we can't democratize a country with 120,000 troops. But in countries in which there are democratizing movements, in Iran, in elsewhere, in Syria certainly there are things, many things we can do. And we have to recover our sense of agency. But the truth is, it really will depend on those societies themselves. That's the good news and the bad news. That's the good news and the bad news.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features the New York Times columnist Roger Cohn and contributing editor and critic of The Atlantic, Leon Wieseltier. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
And that means that there is a process of secularization, of modernization. The grip of the mosque on the public square has got to be broken. And again, we should remember, and I don't mean to go on about this, the struggle to break the grip of the church on the public square in Europe was a struggle that lasted 200 to 300 years, and books were burned and people were burned. So Westerners should not gloat or take for granted that the liberalism that we finally achieved. But finally, I think it will depend on the internecine struggle within these Arab or Muslim societies. And I think it is our duty as Americans to support whatever democratic forces we find in any of these societies. We can't invent them. But if they're there, it would be the height of folly. That's why in June 2009, when the streets of Tehran and elsewhere in Iran, when they erupted for democracy, the fact that Obama did not immediately kindle to this and see that this was in fact... I mean,
Hillary
Clinton
said recently she regretted that more than any
other
single thing.
And Tehran is the big prize, right? I mean, let's not call it regime change. Democratization in Iran changes everything, changes everything. And we have a responsibility to support those people.
It's a very worrying situation, I think, in Europe right now. You have more than 1,000 kids from Britain who have left and adhered to Islamic State. More than 1,500 in France, more than 500 in Germany, and many from Belgium. These are not huge numbers, but they're significant numbers, and there's flux back and forth. And we've seen in Belgium and now in France how dangerous that can be. And those responsible for what happened in France started life as petty criminals. Mm-hmm. They're disaffected. They're getting back to belonging. They don't know where they belong. They don't feel part of the society. And there have been failings on both sides that have created this situation. But I think that combined with rising right-wing parties, weak economies, fearful Jews, marginalized Muslims. It's a heady brew, and there's...
Though I will tell you this, Roger, I'm not one of those people who was ever surprised or disappointed by Europe's failure to integrate the other. My expectations of Europe, owing to what I know from the history of the Jewish experience in Europe, but even the history of the Albigensian experience in Europe, my expectations of Europe in the matter of tolerance have always been very low.
Yeah. It was very interesting, I thought, Leon, in the there was a piece in the New York Times in my paper shortly after the killings in Paris, and a French Jewish woman was being interviewed, and she was talking about being Jewish in France, and then she said, "Mais mon mari, my husband, c'est un vrai Français. He's a real Frenchman." And there you have what is so different between Europe and the United States in a nutshell. Even this family that may have been in France for 100 years, she, as a Jew, considered her husband, who was not Jewish, presumably, he was the real Frenchman. And I think even in the most open of European societies, which is Britain, we are nowhere near. This is one of the things that drew me so strongly to the United States, apart from the exuberant, non-whispering Jewish condition, was this sense that nobody's particularly interested where you're from. It's what you can do.
It's actually
It's far from perfect. Immigration is a big issue. The whole what happened to African Americans over a very long period, to stain on America's conscience. But nevertheless, this fundamental openness is something absolutely exhilarating.
It's even better than that. In Europe, in France, to become a citoyen, and in Europe generally, to be accepted required a huge degree of self-erasure. And in the United States, for a variety of reasons, not only does it not require the erasure of difference, but difference is actually celebrated. Mm-hmm. It's the people without the hyphen who seem un-American, which is an inconceivable situation in Europe.
Yeah.
Inconceivable. And I think that what Europe is stuck now in that it's still that old problem of otherness, of difference. And, you know, in Europe now, there's this phenomenon that didn't exist 50 years ago or 100 years ago, which is known as multiculturalism. Mm-hmm. But in the case of England and in France, sometimes I worry that European multiculturalism is basically an excuse for the societies to ignore the actual social and economic realities of those communities. They can just call it a multiculturalism and not...
Yeah.
And unless they address those realities, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But I've never...
Well, I think it was otherness that... It pushed me out on the road.
Mm-hmm.
That's what journalism suited me, because it meshed with this feeling of otherness. I could go out, mm-hmm. I could be another, and observe people and try to render in words.
You know, the French writer Peggy, who was a close friend of the Zionist essayist Bernard Lazare, who covered the Dreyfus and so on, once said that to be a Jew is to be elsewhere. And there is... Mm. Now, what's interesting about that is that it has all the glamour, as it were, of exile. Mm. But Israeli Jews don't think that. Mm. And American Jews don't think that. Mm. Both of those communities... I mean, you can even think of Israel and America as the two great Jewish experiments in getting away from the terms of Jewish life in Europe.
Yeah.
That's, and by the standards of Jewish history, it's an embarrassment of riches. Mm. It must be said, because this is the friendliest contest for the Jewish future imaginable.
Mm.
But still...
When I went back to... You know, in New York, particularly in America in general, you forget... You're a Jew, and so what? And you live your life, and you never hear any comments of the kind that I think first made me think about being a Jew, which I've already described. But when I went back to Britain, because I've been living there for the last 4 years, and I couldn't have written the book without going back. And in fact, it's interesting, because I always used to say, when people ask, why did you leave Britain? I just said, well, I got a job with Reuters, I went overseas, I was a foreign correspondent, one thing led to another. But no, I wanted to leave. I had to leave the locus of the trauma, the whole story of my mother, and that more general feeling of not being entirely part of things. I don't know. Should we take some questions?
I think it's
the
time
audience,
for questions.
Maybe, yeah.
Okay, thank you so much. So thank you to Leon and Roger. And please just put up your hand. Oh, I know you. Here we go.
About an hour ago, you mentioned, I don't have the words exactly, anti-Semitism in Europe is a result of the seeping of Middle Eastern politics into Europe.
Yeah.
Made me wonder what factor, if a factor at all, you felt the occupation is in the growing anti-Semitism in Europe. My second question, learning about your connection, your family connection to South Africa, and having a glimpse at your political views, I just can't help but ask you how similar, if at all, you feel the occupation is to apartheid in South Africa.
Right. Well, on the first question, it's certainly a factor. As I said, I think a substantial part of the anti-Semitism you're seeing now in Europe is seeping out of the Middle East. Last summer, at the time of the Gaza War, third Gaza War, I was in Gaza in December, somebody said to me, a 9-year-old child in Gaza has seen three wars, knows three wars. That's a 9-year-old child in Gaza's reality. Doesn't need to read any history books or already seen that. And has it changed anything? No, it hasn't. The last Gaza war took 2,300 lives for nothing, nothing. Hamas is still there. Okay, the tunnels, some of the tunnels were removed, but it was a war that changed nothing, and there will be another one. In any event, while that was going on, you had demonstrations throughout Europe. I was a correspondent in Germany. If you told me when I was a correspondent in 1998, 2001, that there would be people in the street, Germans, in the streets of Germany, Turkish Germans, other Germans, saying, Jews are pigs, I would have said, you're crazy. That's over. That's not going to happen again here. But feeling is running very high in Europe, where, incidentally, Zionism is now a dirty word. It's interesting for me because in the United States, I tend to be criticized mainly for my criticisms of Israel, for saying that the occupation must end, that you have to get to two states. In Europe, I'm criticized more from the other side for being a Zionist, for believing in the need for a Jewish homeland. So I think when Europeans see the continued growth of the settlements, see an occupation that is now coming up, very soon it'll be a half century, and see an Israeli, you can rightly say this is unbalanced, they don't focus as much on the failings on the other side, and that's true, but there's exasperation in Europe, and there's fury, anger, and politicization among the Muslims of Europe, who number in the millions. So I think all that... now, many Europeans will say to you, I'm not anti-Semitic, I'm anti-Zionist. I think the distinction in moments of high emotion like some last summer becomes flimsy to the point of being impossible to actually discern. It's an anti-Zionism that falls into anti-Semitism. So, to turn your question around, would it make a difference if the occupation ended and a two-state peace were reached to the climate in Europe and to the degree of anti-Semitism that is beginning to emerge? I think it would make a difference. Would it resolve it? No.
Roger, I have to disagree a little bit.
Yeah.
I think that, I mean, I agree with every syllable, obviously, yeah, as you know, of your critique of your horror of the occupation and of the settlement policy and so on. That's certainly the case. I think that if it's anti-Semitism we're talking about, there is no rational connection between even the settlement policy and anti-Semitism. I think generally, as a general rule, but in the understanding of prejudice, I think it's very important never to explain a prejudice in terms of the object of the prejudice. Mm-hmm. In other words, if you want to understand racism, you don't study blacks, you study whites, because the whites are the racists. And if you want to understand misogyny, you don't study the women, you study the men. Mm-hmm. Because if you study the women, you're concurring with the misogynists that it actually is a response to something in the women. Mm-hmm. And if you want to understand anti-Semitism, I believe, mm-hmm, you study the non-Jews, not the Jews. Mm-hmm. I've always thought, for that reason, that anti-Semitism, which is always taught in courses in Jewish history, mm-hmm, should be taught in courses in non-Jewish history.
Right,
because we are not the anti-Semites, we are the Semites.
Right.
Right? And I think, therefore, I'm a little stricter. I think that most anti-Semitism would be completely unaffected by a change in Israeli government policy, because I think it is... Now, that does not mean for a second that Israeli government policy should not be changed. I feel like we have to make that clear. But I do think that liberals and doves especially have to be very clear-eyed about the roots of anti-Semitism, the durability of anti-Semitism, and its nature as a prior prejudice.
Yeah.
And that's, et cetera, et cetera.
I think I agree with what you say, Leon. I wasn't precise enough, but I do think that among young Muslims in Europe, the way the events in the Middle East are pervade to them, there is a reaction that spirals out of control.
Sure.
And manifest itself, recently at least, as anti-Semitism. And that is growing. Anyway, to move on to the second question, I don't use the word apartheid for Israeli policies in the West Bank. However, for any South African, anyone who's spent time in South Africa, if you drive along a road, apartheid was a particular system in a particular place and involved the policies it did toward the heinous policies it did toward the blacks of South Africa. But there are echoes. There are definitely echoes. If you travel on a road in the West Bank and it's for Israelis only, it's not for Palestinians. If you see the kinds of small humiliations that are inflicted on Palestinians, I think, almost daily, it's hard not to feel echoes. And one, there are a couple of chapters. I follow my family, the Zionists in my family, from South Africa to Israel. And their daughter was manic depressive, the same as my mother. And she committed suicide at the age of 28. And I tell the story of this cousin of mine, and also her parents, one of whom was liberal, and one of whom was a Likudnik. And she, my cousin, always felt these echoes, right from 1967 onward. She was troubled by this sense of another people out there that we're trying to ignore. We're trying to pretend they're not there. Construction everywhere. If we're going to give this land back, why are we building? And her husband would say, get used to it. Get used to it. We won. Yeah. And Russian Jews, of course, the new Russian Jews think, what is this? Give back land you won in conquest? If Russia had ever done that, what would it be today? So they don't get it. But and I try to, you know, examine this tension through telling the story of my cousin. But yeah, the echoes are there. We've spoken a lot about suicide, displacement, upheaval. I wouldn't like you to think that that is the fundamental message of the book, because my mother, after mental illness, the cancer she died of 15 years ago was a derisory thing. She held it in complete contempt. It was nothing compared to what she'd been through. And she was unbelievably stoical and loving in death. And her spirit has proved very powerful. And looking back over the peregrinations of my family, I felt repeatedly the force of love and dignity coming through. And I think that's the final message I would like to leave you with. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you very much.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and 91.7 KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guests were the New York Times columnist Roger Cohn and contributing editor and critic of The Atlantic, Leon Wieseltier. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Brandon Battaglia, Ben Bernardi, Maya Finley, and Alex Espelet. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I invite you to tune in again next Thursday at noon when Bina will feature chef, food writer, and restaurateur Yotam Ottolenghi. I'm Barbara Lane. Thanks for listening.